We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hi, students, teachers, others who have joined us for today. Thank you for taking the time for this. I'm here with Gary Vykerk. Thank you, Gary, for being here with us.
Been looking forward to it.
Well, it's great to have you. So our audience looks to be over 50% middle and high school teachers and classes. So because of that, we're going to address this program today mainly to students of those levels and to the questions that have been sent in for them. And I will be giving Gary the opportunity whenever he wishes to take the questions and run with them, Gary. So you feel free to tell us stories as you're comfortable with. We want to connect with the students a little bit, though. So to begin with, would you be willing to tell us a little about growing up and what got you up to the military service and just prompted you to join up?
Yeah, as I look back and reflect upon growing up and how I ended up working in a middle school classroom as a school counselor for 33 years, I've often thought about how did I get here? You know, sometimes you have those experiences where you question where you are at that particular time. And with me, I had probably the unique experience at the time. During the late 40s and early 50s, my parents were divorced, which was not a common thing back then. And so growing up with a single parent family for a long time, I ended up attending 11 different schools before I even hit ninth grade. We would move quite often, moving with aunts and other extended family members. So even though I never really knew my father, he left when I was about 4 or 5 years old. I had a real strong support system, a family support system, where I learned the importance of depending upon one another. And when I'd move into a new household with my aunts or something, I would always be given certain jobs that were my job to do. And so I learned an interdependence of how to function within a different setting. And that made me be flexible. It also developed a certain amount of independence and outside of the box thinking. Plus also maybe a little bit of trying to always prove myself, because maybe that was because I didn't have a father growing up, but I always seemed to be motivated by something that I had to do my best and be my best at something. And looking back at that, I think those were probably very important characteristics that I carried with me throughout life and that were very beneficial to me when I decided to go into the military. Which is an interesting story. The only reason when I graduated from high school, the girl I was going with at the time, she said, "What are you going to do when we graduate?" And I said, "What are you going to do?" She said, "Well, I'm going to go to Brockport College, a local college." I said, "Okay, I'm going to go to Brockport too." Then she said, "Well, what are you going to major in?" And I said, "What are you majoring in?" And she said, "Phys Ed." And I said, "Okay, I'll major in Phys Ed too." And so we went to college together. We were there 3 months and she broke up with me. And so here I was in college, not really knowing. It was one of those things like, how did I really get here?
You know? So you got a quick lesson on how to make decisions, perhaps on your own.
Yeah, I didn't have too much of a good career decision-making strategy at the time. But then after your girlfriend breaks up with you, I did what any red-blooded American young guy would do. I said, I'm going to join the Army. You know, so I quit college and went into the military. And a good friend of mine, he also had a similar experience, girl breaking up with him, and he wanted me to go into the Marines with him. And I said, I'm not going to join the Marines. Those guys are crazy. I said, I'm going to join the Green Berets. And so
And that was less crazy?
That was less crazy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But I found out that the Green Berets actually were looking for people who had that particular unique set of skill set of an independence, creative thinking, a willingness to try things out of the box, but yet knowing how to work with others. So that my upbringing, as I look back on it, really fitted me well with going into special forces.
So you mentioned 11 different homes. Did you change schools that often as well, or were you mainly in the same community?
Most of the time I changed schools, yeah. I think I was looking at it this morning, and I think I can remember 10 different schools that I went to before I hit ninth grade. And it was in ninth grade that I eventually left home and moved in with an aunt, which was where I ended up staying until I graduated from high school.
Wow. Well, we have a lot of kids these days who, both because of family situations or because of families' job situations, have to change schools often. And while that seems like a major challenge for students, you certainly made the best of it. So it's good to look at that as a positive.
Yeah, my work with the students, the middle school students, many times they would talk with students who came from broken homes or who were living, being raised by grandparents, or many times were living in foster care. So I felt that the experiences that I had allowed me to develop some empathy with them and be able to identify a little bit with some of the things they may have been feeling or struggling with at the time. So it was very beneficial.
Thank you for sharing that about your growing up years. I'm going to assume that most of those of you who are watching with your teachers have already read Gary's citation for his Medal of Honor action, and that you therefore know a little bit about his war service. So we're not going to go into details of the Medal of Honor action, but we do have a couple of questions here that I think fit in with what you'd like to talk about with character and developing character and growing up. And one of the things that one of our students asked was, how did serving in the armed forces change you as a person and your relationship with others? And I would say specifically, you were telling me a little yesterday, you mentioned that in one of your interviews that living with the Montagnards in Vietnam really shaped you as a young man. Mm-hmm. So how long were you with them before you actually went into combat or ended up with your Medal of Honor service and then were medevaced out? Were you with them a long time? And can you tell us what you learned from them?
Yeah, I had lived with them for approximately a year. We were living in the central highlands of Vietnam out near the Laotian border. And it was a very remote camp, as most special forces camps were. The only way to get to the camp was by helicopter. We didn't have any kind of roads going through the jungle. The only people that had that were the North Vietnamese, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was like a major highway going down through the jungles. But I lived with them in a camp called Doc Xiang. And living in a situation like that, you really learn to develop a dependence upon one another. And being with Special Forces, one of the things that we were taught with was is to be sensitive to the culture, be sensitive to the individuals that you are working with. Don't go in as a know-it-all and like say, I'm going to show you how to do all these things. And many times during my life, I've seen individuals who are in a teaching situation and they take on the role of, well, I'm the expert, you are the uninformed, ignorant one, and I'm going to show you all that you need to do. And that kind of an approach to people turns people off immediately. It makes them very, very defensive. And so I learned that by going into a situation like living with people of a different culture, going with the attitude of, what can you teach me? How can I learn from you what you have learned? You are people who have lived in this situation for hundreds and hundreds of years, and you've grown up and survived in the jungle, and now I'm here. I need you to help me. So there was a humility that was instilled in many Special Forces individuals, because a humility is one of the critical keys to being able to share information with other people, to be able to have an impact with them. If you go in with a humble spirit, people are going to be more open to you. And so living with the Montagnards, I learned a humility, because they conveyed to me a sense of humility. And not only humility, but a genuine commitment of care and trust for one another. They were a very sincere people. They had a very strong value system of depending upon one another and of being truthful with one another. They had learned that in order to survive, you need to be able to depend upon that person who is next to you. In the military, we call that a camaraderie. And a camaraderie can be defined as having a relationship with someone that you are willing to put your life in their hands and say, I trust you with my life. And then having the same kind of relationship with them that allows them to put their life into your hands. And when that happens with a people, when that happens with an individual, there's a bond that's created that's like no other. And even though there was a tremendous sense of camaraderie among the guys with the special forces, mm-hmm. that camaraderie was enhanced by having the mountain yards that we lived with become part of that camaraderie. And there was, in that camaraderie also, the way I like to define it is it's like when you think of yourself, you can't think of yourself without thinking of the other people that you're with. It's like when you, my identity is not just me alone, but my identity is wrapped up into the 12 Americans that I serve with. It's with the 2,000 other people that are in the villages that I'm working with. I can't think of myself without thinking of the other person. And so that helped me to develop a spirit of serving others, thinking about others, which allowed me to be selfless many times in my actions and in my commitment to them. It was not about me. It was about others.
Well, it sounds like the relationship there is so important. I'm going to bet that a lot of our students, many of whom come from homes where the main language at home is different from at school, are already thinking about this question. And that's it. Did you speak these people's language when you went over there, or how did you learn it once you got there?
It's an interesting thing about the mountain yards. They had a pretty rudimentary language. And so I worked with three different tribes of mountain yards. And each one of them had a different dialect.
Wow.
So I could speak with the Benar mountain yards, which were down more in the central part of Tukor, down around Bamituit and Pleiku. And then further north, there were the Jirai mountain yards that I had worked with a bit. They spoke Jirai. And then the ones where I spent the most time with was the Sedang. And so many times you could speak their language and learn it very quickly. There was a lot of gestures, almost like a sign language. Mm-hmm. So I found it very easy to be able to communicate with them. And they were so willing to, you know, kind of laugh when you'd make mistakes. And the relationship that we had really made it an ideal situation for learning something new in a language. I kind of had a good potential for that. When I did my army testing, they said that that was one of my strong points, was my verbal abilities to learning languages. So it was.
But the army didn't train you in Vietnamese at all before you went overseas.
You know, we tried. We learned a few phrases and stuff, but those were the kind of phrases that would probably just get me in trouble more than help me out.
Well, our reliance on language, especially in academic settings, is so heavy that I so admire those of you who speak more than one language. I think that's great. Mm-hmm. Some of the other questions that are included here would be, someone asked, during your military service, and I said I wasn't going to talk about this much, but someone asked, when faced with the need to make an immediate decision, what was going through your mind? And I don't know that applies specifically to your Medal of Honor action, but obviously you have some ideas about decision making that you might want to share with our students.
Yeah. Nudge me if I get off on too long of an explanation or an answer to that question, but that question really triggers some thoughts in my mind. I mentioned that I worked 33 years as a middle school counselor, and I developed what I called life lessons, things that I wanted to teach the students about life. And one of the things that I taught them was that all of us actually live our life in the context of war. And I would tell them that, you know, I went to Vietnam and I fought a war. But I fought many wars before I got to Vietnam because I learned that where the wars are fought and where wars or battles are either won or lost is first of all in your heart and in your mind. That's where the battles really take place. And another thing I said to them was that you win or lose by the things that you choose. And if your battles are fought in your heart and your mind, that's where you learn that, what am I going to do in this situation? Fear, when fear comes into your life, fear many times will create some panic. Panic then creates doubt. And once doubt enters your mind, that's when you start making mistakes. You become careless. And in any situation that involves a war, whether there's bullets flying or any kind of decision making that you have to make, it could be just finding yourself in the hall and you see somebody being bullied. You're fighting a battle right there in your heart and in your mind. And what you need to use to make a decision then, whether you're going to be a winner or a loser in that situation, is you have to take what's been put into your heart and what's been put into your mind. And you have to then decide, what am I going to do in this situation? And if fear takes over, doubt's going to creep in, and then you're thinking about protecting myself. And I think that what we learned in the military was that the way to combat fear from getting into your life and causing you to make a decision that you're going to later regret is that what combats fear is training. When something happens in a situation and you find yourself in a crisis or in a conflict, immediately training kicks in. And many of the individuals that receive the Medal of Honor, they would say, what caused you to do that? Weren't you afraid? And I honestly have to say, I don't really know if I was afraid. I didn't really have time to feel anything about fear because immediately my training kicked in. I was trained as a medic. I was trained to respond. I was trained to care for others. And that immediately kicked in. And that replaced any kind of a fear. And it allowed me to do what I needed to do what I was trained to do. And in the same way with any of the battles that we fight, like I said, the real battles are fought and won and in your heart and in your mind. So I always try to encourage the students, train for the battles. Train by realizing and being careful to choose what you're allowing to get into your heart and what are you putting into your mind. Are you putting in things that are going to help you grow? Are you putting into your heart things that will help you care for others? Are you putting into your mind good thoughts, things that are going to enable you to make the right choice? Because you're going to win or lose by the things that you choose. And so fear was, many times guys say, sure, I felt fear, but I honestly can say I didn't really feel fear at all because my training immediately kicked in. Where I started to feel fear was later on. Then I was worried I was going to die, and that's a whole other story.
But. Okay. All right. Well, and we might get to that. You've mentioned a couple of times that you spent a career as a middle school counselor, but before we get to that, which as a teacher myself, I have to say that that's one of the things that scares me, frankly. Sorry, middle schoolers, but I've raised some of my own. So I know that that's a challenge all its own, but students have asked that after the war, what was the hardest thing for you about coming back to civilian life? Was it part of that deciding what you were going to do to transition out of the military and to civilian life? Do you have anything you want to share with us about those decisions?
Remind me of that question in case I get rambling on something. But what caught my mind is that I always used to say that Vietnam was good training for working with middle schoolers. You know that if, and I would often recommend to anybody before they get sent into a battle, they ought to spend at least 2 weeks in the seventh grade classroom. If you can survive 2 weeks with seventh graders, you can survive anything. But my greatest fear in returning to civilian life from the military was that while in Vietnam, I was exposed, I experienced, I was involved in many actions and decisions that I made that were scary for me, and that I never thought that those things could become a part of my life. Some of the things that I saw there, I couldn't believe that what I saw. Some of the things that I felt, I never felt before. I mean, like I had felt anger before, and I had felt even hate before, but the intensity of that anger, the intensity of that hate, and what that, those feelings motivated me to do were scary. And some of those actions revealed a side of myself that I found very difficult to live with. I couldn't accept those things. And consequently, my fear was that if people knew me like I knew me, people were really able to get inside of me and see what I had done, see what I had felt, see what I had considered doing, they would be abhorred. They would be shocked. I would feel a tremendous rejection from that. So consequently, in order to protect myself, I tried building walls to keep people away from me. So I became very aloof when I first returned from military. And I tried to go back to college. I had some bad experiences. I got spit on at college. I'm called a baby killer. College was not the best place to be in the 70s. And those kinds of experiences just added to the negative way in which I saw myself. As a matter of fact, many times I would hear some of those things that they would say to me, and I'd say, I'd kind of laugh a little bit, and I'd say, I could think of even worse things to call myself because of some of what I feel inside. But I couldn't live with that. And living with walls built around yourself was not a way to develop relationships. It was not a way to function and to try to transition back to civilian life. So what I decided to do was that I actually said the thing to do would be to just separate myself from people. And I actually took off to northern New Hampshire, and I lived in a cave for 2 years in the mountains of New Hampshire. And it was during that time that I began to try to wrestle with all that chaos that had become my life. I tried to find a place for what I wanted to be in my life. There was a saying that we had in Vietnam that I used to really reflect on in that cave, and that was, to really live, you must almost die. To those that fight for it, life has a meaning the protected will never know. And I had fought for my life in Vietnam. I fought for my life in the hospital bed when I thought I was going to die, passing out and going unconscious, wondering if this is it. Is this what death is really like? I fought hard to stay awake, not to go unconscious. And so I fought for life. And so while I was in that cave, I tried to refocus and reflect upon things and try to develop some understanding of what I had gone through so that I could build a foundation in my life that would allow me to leave the cave and to transition back to society, being comfortable with myself, feeling okay that I'm willing to let people into my life again. And so that was the biggest fear that I felt returning, was just being able to function in life outside of the cave, living with other people. Because if I didn't know if I could risk letting them get close enough to me to really see me as I saw myself. So that was a real big struggle for years. And there are times when I still slip back into that cave. I feel like I have a tendency sometimes to just say, maybe I should go back into the cave. It was safe. It was nice.
Well, you know, your choice to live in a literal cave has so much meaning for us on a metaphorical level. When you've mentioned it, students, we see students do this too, that they withdraw as a way of protection. But that sort of comes back around to your early comment about fear and making choices to face your fear so that you can make the difficult decisions. Mm-hmm. And now it was during that, so we'll come back for a minute to some matter of fact things. It was while you were living in that cave, though, the literal cave, that you got a call, a notice that you were supposed to make a phone call or be ready for a phone call that had to do with you receiving the Medal of Honor.
Right. Yeah.
Now, did that change things for you right away, or did it gradually influence the way you came to terms with what had happened and what you had to do as part of your job as a soldier in the war?
It was interesting. I I really started enjoying living in the cave. And actually, sometimes I have to clarify with students, they said they just stay there all the time. And actually, there was a town nearby, Lancaster, which one of the reasons I went up there was that because of some of the experiences in Vietnam, I had become a Christian. And I felt forgiveness from God, but I needed to try to sort out my life. And there was a seminary in that town, Bible college. So I used to go into the town and I would take classes and things. And during that time, I started, like I said, I started to really feel better about myself. I really enjoyed the solitude. I enjoyed the safety and the security of living in that cave. And then all of a sudden I did get that phone call. It was in September of 73 that I was going to be awarded the Medal of Honor. And all of a sudden, all that stuff that I've been trying to forget, because I was still under the assumption that forgetting is getting better. Mm-hmm. If I can just forget it, I'm going to be better. And when that phone call came, all that stuff came rushing back, all the things that happened in Vietnam, all the people that had died, all the people that had been a tremendous part of my life were important to me. The guilt that I was still alive while they're dead, all that came back, and here I'm trying to forget, and now they're going to give me a medal for something that happened during that time. And so that did turn my world upside down. I reluctantly accepted, and I went down to Washington and went to the ceremony. Many of the guys that were received the medal at the same time as I did, there was 9 of us. They were very excited and celebrations and everything. And I just stayed in my room in the hotel. I didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel any kind of excitement or pride or anything. I just felt guilt. And I felt all those other things that had haunted me all those years. And so after the ceremony was over, I returned to Northern New Hampshire, went back into my cave, and I put the medal in my duffel bag. And actually, I never took it out again until after I was married, which became about, 4 or 5 years later is when I first took it out. And actually, I remember the time that my wife was going through some of my stuff, and she found the citation for the Medal of Honor. And I was at work, and she came home, or she hung the citation up on the wall. And I came home and I saw it, and I told her we had to take it down. I didn't feel worthy. I didn't feel comfortable. It was a tough thing to deal with, wearing the Medal of Honor. And so I spent quite a few years trying to deal with understanding what that Medal of Honor meant and being willing to wear it. And that was a struggle.
Well, you received your medal at a time when the country was probably at its most divisive over the Vietnam War, right? Mm-hmm. There in the early 1970s. And I'm sure that contributed to that. But I also want to point out to students, in case students haven't read Gary's citation, most of your citation is in relationship to you being a medic and attempting, both successfully and attempting, to save other people's lives and quite literally sacrificing your own health and well-being in that effort, and even after you were already badly wounded. So I just want to point out yours, most medals of honor are not necessarily offensive. They are very often defensive, and almost always include the Medal of Honor recipient's effort to save the lives of those he is with, which is the nature actually of some many battles anyway. Mm-hmm. So that there are lots of different kinds of guilt that goes with war, and that survivor's guilt is one of the most difficult.
Mm-hmm. If I could, you mentioned the citation, and many times if I go to speak somewhere as an introduction, they'll read the citation. And I often have to tell them, that when I hear my citation being read, I don't hear the words that are being read. it's still with me today. What I hear are screams and people crying and people dying and explosions. That's what I hear. But then I also have to make a correction because my citation says that at one point that I unhesitatingly moved through withering fire and things like that. And I jokingly say, whoever wrote that citation wasn't there, really, because to say that I moved unhesitatingly is really a mistake. There was a lot of hesitation moving, you know. And the other thing is that I didn't move by myself. I had already been shot once, and I couldn't move. I couldn't walk. And so the reason I was able to do what I did that warranted me being awarded a Medal of Honor was that I was being carried by two of my Mountain Yard friends, one of which was a 15-year-old Mountain Yard boy named Dale. He carried me through that battle and through those the days of that attack and being wounded. He carried me in spite of the fact that he was wounded a number of times. And eventually we heard a rocket coming in and he threw himself on top of me and was killed protecting me. And so that was also part of the guilt that I carried with me, that this 15-year-old boy gave his life for me. But it was that sacrifice that he made that instilled in me the motivation and the passion and the vision to be able to work with young people for 33 years, because Dale showed me that within each young person, you know, you talk about those battles that are fought and won in their heart and in your mind. Each young person has that potential to make those right decisions, to care about another to the point where you'd be willing to literally risk your life for that person. And those battles are fought in your heart and in your mind. And that's one of the other things I learned, is that life is not dependent on age. So many times young people say, I can't wait till I'm 15, I can't wait till I'm 16 or 18, because then I can do this. Then I can achieve this. Then I can have this kind of a success. Well, I've also learned that there's a big difference in life between success and significance. And what matters to me now is significance. And significance is made moment by moment, deciding that you're going to do the right thing. Moment by moment, deciding that others are more important than me. And Deo taught me that it doesn't matter how old you are. You, as a 15-year-old, can now make decisions that will make a tremendous difference in the lives of somebody that will change their life forever. That person that you see in the hall being picked on, or that person who sits by themselves in the cafeteria with nobody talking to them, you can choose to make a difference in that person's life. And by God's grace, if you get to be a little bit older, you look back on your life, and what will matter is not the successes that you've had in life, but those moments when you've been able to make a difference in someone's life. Dale is not listed in the who's who of American students. You know, he didn't live past 15 years old, but he had the most significant impact of my life. And so life is not dependent on your age. Life matters on what you choose to do in that moment when you can either make a decision to care for someone, to make a difference, to risk going outside of yourself. And sometimes the students say, well, Mr. B, you're asking me to die for that person? I said, no, don't die, but maybe risk embarrassment, maybe risk a little bit of rejection from others for that person. That's when you will find out that life takes on significance for you, is when you live outside of yourself and start caring for others.
There are lots of ways, again, not literal, to save a life. And one thing if students aren't already thinking about that, is you tell us the story of Dale and in his literal sacrifice of throwing himself on you and then saving you, it has allowed you to in turn work with all these middle schoolers over 33 years. If you did the math on that, students, you figure that out, how many students Mr. Bykirk would have seen in a year and multiply that by 33. How many lives have you influenced who have then mm-hmm. gone on to influence other lives? I mean, that's of great significance. Thank you for sharing that with us. And that may be the answer to this question, but one of our viewers wrote in a question that is, what is one thing you wish more people knew about your experience? And perhaps Dale was the answer to that, but is there anything in particular that comes to mind that you wish more people knew about your experience? or perhaps even your experience with the Medal of Honor. I noticed you said something about the weight of wearing that medal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of things that go with the medal, and one of them is a burden. And I've learned that what that burden is the falling under the misconception that you're something special, that you're more than you really are.
Well said.
I know who I am, and you really have to fight that that risk or that danger of saying, I'm a pretty special guy. You know, you're not. I found that when I put this medal on, there's no room for self when I wear this. It's not about me. It's about every man and woman who has risked their life or has raised their hand and has put on a uniform, because I've learned that this medal shares a message. It's not about one person who did one thing on one particular day, but it represents a different way of living. It represents that there are millions and millions of men and women who over the years have decided that they wanted to choose to serve others more than self. And so they put on a uniform. And so when I wear this medal, I wear it for them. I wear it for families who have lost a loved one in war. I wear it for the student, the young person who just graduates from basic training, and they put their uniform on and they can't wait to get home because they're feeling pride in the fact that they're doing something for their country because they love this country and they can't wait to get home and show their friends and their family. This medal is worn for them. So I've learned that this is not about me, but the medal is about others. And it when people see this medal, there's a common tradition of people saluting when you're wearing the medal. And the danger is to think of that they're saluting you. They're not saluting me. They're saluting the medal, because that medal represents what lives in the hearts and what lives in the minds of every man and woman who's put on a uniform and has defended this country. When we're saluted, that's what's being saluted. It's the spirit. It's what lives in the hearts and minds of us. It's what makes me cry when I hear taps. Mm-hmm. It's what makes me sometimes choke up when I can't finish the national anthem, because I think about this country and about the freedoms and the willingness of so many people to sacrifice themselves for those freedoms and for those values that this country was founded upon. So when this medal is saluted, that's what's being saluted. It's not the person wearing it. It's the medal itself and what the medal represents. So what kind of life experience? I think the greatest life experience that I've had is being able and willing to risk opening up. And risk having that, you know, the risk, as I said earlier, was that if somebody really knew me like I knew myself, they'd hate me. I've learned that that's a lonely way to live. Mm-hmm. And actually people ask me, you know, if you love the cave so much, why did you come out of the cave? And I jokingly say that, well, the reason I came out of the cave was in that small little town of Lancaster, I came across a young, pretty little blonde young lady named Maureen or Lolly, fell in love with her, and I asked her to marry me. And she said, on one condition. I said, what's that? She said, I'm not coming in that cave with you. You got to come out of the cave. So since she wouldn't go into the cave with me, I came out of the cave. But I also came out of the cave because I felt that during that time in the cave, that there was a message being formed in my heart that needed to be shared. And that message is about love and about caring for others. And there's a risk that's involved with opening up yourself and allowing somebody else to have entrance into your hurts, to have entrance into your deepest thoughts and your deepest feelings. But once you're able to do that, that's when life really starts, because then you're opened up and you're able to really experience what life is really all about, and you're able to develop those significant moments that I mentioned. And there's a story of a young girl that I met as a sixth grader. And I was always knocking on her door. I call that, I'd go up and talk to her and smile. But I knew that she had some tremendous walls around her built up because I knew some of her background. And she had grown up in an alcoholic family, had a very abusive relationships with others, even as a sixth grader. And so I kept on knocking on her door. In sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, she never opened up. And when she made the trip from middle school to high school, I remember walking with her and telling her, there may be some time when you want to talk. I just want you to know that I'll be there. And then sometime later, I got a phone call about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I answered the phone and she said, "Hey, Mr. B." I said, "Yeah." And she said, "It's me. Or, can we talk?" And I said, "Sure." And so we met at a grocery store that's open 24 hours a day. We met at 2 o'clock in the morning and then we sat and talked. She was 23 years old. It was it took her at that point before she was willing to really open up and allow others to enter her life, to risk all that fear that she felt, all that, all those things that kept, that made her wall so very strong all those years. She was willing to let that go and open up and allow a person to come in. And that's what love does. That's the power of love. And the power of love has been a tremendous force in my life. It's a life-changing experience to open up and to allow people to love you and then to risk becoming a part of someone else's life and loving them unconditionally, loving them. And maybe not, you don't understand everything that they're going through. I can't understand every experience, but I can listen and I can love you in return. And that has been a big part of my life.
Well, I seem to keep coming up with the questions after you've already given me the answers. But one of our viewers asked what advice you would have for students who struggle to find where they fit in. Mm-hmm. And do you have anything in particular that you want to, I think you've already told students pretty much everything that you needed to tell them, but is there anything you want to add to that? Or?
Well, I kind of alluded to this, that my faith is an important part of my life. And one of the other things that helped me come out of the cave is, like I said, is my wife telling me she wouldn't come in and then feeling that I had a message that needed to be shared. And part of that message was the realization that is that in a sense, every one of us is a very, very unique person. We were created. It's not just happenstance that we're here. It's not happenstance that things that happen to you happen to you. There's a purpose for it. We were created for a purpose. And many times I have to remind myself that there's a reason that I survived Vietnam. I just recently fought a year and a half battle with colon cancer. And there's a reason that I survived that. And during that year and a half of going through chemo and facing the doubts of, you know, God, I thought I had a purpose here and now I'm going to die of cancer. What is this? You know, I have to hold on to that vision that there is a purpose and there is a reason that I am still here. I still have a job to do. God isn't finished with me yet because I'm still here. I woke up this morning. I breathe. My feet hit the floor. I can walk and my heart and my mind still work. I'm able to share things. And so all that's part of my message and part of my vision and my purpose for being. And I try to encourage the students that they are very, very special, very, very unique. They are one of a kind creation. And each one of them has a reason for being. And their reason is so special, I can't fulfill their purpose. I can't do the things that they were created to do. That's for them to do. And you, what will give you significance is life. And when you're looking for that significant feeling, once you find out what you're supposed to do and you're doing it, you will achieve a sense of significance, a sense of purpose, a sense of, wow, I really matter. I was created for a reason. It's not, I have value to others. It's important that I'm alive. That purpose will give you the encouragement that you need. It'll give you the comfort that you need. It'll give you the strength to make it through a day. And many times it's just making it day by day, moment by moment. But if you can latch onto that purpose, those moments will come. You'll fight that battle here and in here. And knowing that you have a purpose there, which is part of in your heart and your mind, that'll give you what you need to make it through that day and make it right through to the next day and the next. And no matter what comes your way, that vision, that purpose will guide and direct and get you through the real tough times of life.
We live in a time when there is a very unfortunate and ugly statistic about the suicide rate going mm-hmm. on. Not only we hear it advertised about the men and women in our armed forces and specifically our veterans, but we also live in a time when we're dealing with it in our schools. And I think what you just said, which, by the way, teachers and students, this webinar is being taped and you may revisit it later to listen again, because there's so much of value here. But one of the things that I would point out is that what you just said, that purpose, finding that purpose, it's, you can only do that when you're alive, that suicide is never the solution, never the final solution. And so thank you for sharing that with us, because I think that ties in so many ways to challenges that teachers and students are facing, especially when people might be choosing to give up without any, what to others, if they would just ask for help, might not be as horrible a problem as they think it is.
We make some real tough decisions many times when the purpose of that decision is, I just want to change the way I feel. I don't like feeling like this anymore. And I want to change how I feel. And so often, whether you're a student or whether you were a vet returning from war, the choices, alcohol, drugs, building walls, all too often it's, I'm just going to end my life. And like I said, I fought in that hospital bed to stay alive. I fought in that cave to find a meaning for life. And life is so precious to me now that the thought of giving up, the thought of ending my life before my purpose is fulfilled, it's just not even in my thinking. And that's what I try to instill in the students. And I guess it comes down to just one word. Most of us are looking for hope. Give me a reason to face tomorrow. Better yet, give me a reason to face the next minute. Give me a reason to want to walk out of this classroom and start to walk out into those halls where kids are going to start mocking me or where kids are going to start rejecting me. Just give me a reason to want to do that. And hope, I found, is the reason.
One of the interviews that you did for the Medal of Honor Society or Foundation previously, and that's part of our character development program, teacher trainings, and it's available on our website, includes a clip of you saying that you don't believe that you truly learn to serve until you learn there is something more important than yourself.
Right.
And I think that what you just described to us reflects that focus of taking your focus outside instead of inside and looking what you can do for others instead of yourself. And that mm-hmm. seems to help change that.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I did a message once on leadership, and I said that in a crisis, people look for somebody who seems to have something that they don't have. I mean, in a crisis, there are three kinds of people. There are people who know what's going on and know what to do. There are people who just kind of sit back and watch what's going on. And then there are people who have no clue what's going on. So what we need in our world today is people who are truly leaders, those who know what's going on and know what to do in a crisis. And I really believe that you will never lead until you learn to serve, and you'll never serve until you learn that there's something more important in life than self. And so that was the beginning of my belief on a style of leadership, and that is the servant leadership, being able to serve others. Because in a crisis, people look for that. I think of as Mr. Ruscola during 9/11. Mm-hmm. He was a former military man, and he was a leader when the Twin Towers fell. And he sacrificed his life, saved hundreds of people because they followed him. They saw something in him that they didn't feel in, that they didn't have in themselves. And they said, you know something that I don't know. I'd like that, but until I can have it, at least I'm going to follow you. And what that is that there's something in life more important than me, and that is helping others, serving others, and being willing to risk whatever it costs in order to live my life that way. And that's what a real leader is.
Well, thank you. Our hour has flown by and it's pretty much up. Is there anything you want to say before I take us to the last slide on how to find this later?
This is actually, since my journey with cancer, this is really my first venture into not being a shut-in. I've been a shut-in for a year and a half, and I'm really honored to be able to share this time with each of you as students, as educators. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to share a little bit of what's important to me.
Well, thank you for letting us be part of your journey back into working with educators. And in fact, I saw on the screen up there little comments from our Medal of Honor trainers saying, welcome back, Gary. I know they are excited to have you back, and we can hardly wait until you're well enough to get back into the classroom. Thank you to all those who have spent the hour with us listening and learning. And I hope that you'll revisit this webinar and listen and learn still more and apply it to what you're doing in your everyday lives in your classrooms to get your continuing education certificate. Teachers who need that for watching, the instructions are on the screen there for you. It will be mailed to you within 24 hours if you were pre-registered for today. And if you join the session, if you watch the session later, then you'll follow the directions that are there on the screen for you and on the website. EdWeb provides you all the information that you need for that. The Medal of Honor Foundation offers the character development program on a thumb drive for teachers. You may request one online, access to all the free character program plans, and also Gary's living history is on our website, along with the compilation videos where he talks about some of the things he mentioned today. And teachers, you may sign up for a training in your area. Look at our dates online. And I would most of all like to mention, if you sign up for our newsletter, you get early announcements of upcoming webinars and such, which takes us to an important announcement about the webinar next month, which will be with Medal of Honor recipient Joe Jackson, who was awarded the Medal of Honor for actions in Vietnam, but who served this country in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And so we're looking forward to talking with Joe Jackson next month. Thank you again for joining us today. You can join the EdWeb community at the website listed on your screen to get all the free resources that go with both EdWeb and to find further information about the Medal of Honor Foundation.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.